Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. That debt is fraud. And as we go through the last, few, I guess, week or two of the Constitutional Convention, hopefully you're actually seeing how there were some very significant changes where they originally wanted the federal legislature, Congress, to be able to control this, and this. They took that away from them. And so you have to read the Constitution clearly and carefully to ensure that whether Congress has any authority to change any part of what you're looking at, because the only area that Congress has the ability, one, to create laws on and or to have any effect over those, in other words, to apply rules, regulations to the states, are in Article 1, Section 8. They cannot change any language or a number in the Constitution. Those numbers are fixed, i.e. the apportionment number of 30,000 and so forth. So, as we are ready to gain forward, we are jump into this again. We've got Tammy with us today. Welcome back, Tammy. And we have Sean with us today. Welcome back, Sean.
Thank you, sir.
All right. So, folks, we're now where we left off on the 23rd of August. This is Mr. Madison. He's a bit down. We're on page 353, and towards the very bottom of that, and the subtopic that we actually have in here is county and militia. They even bring up the county regarding the militia. So go ahead, Tammy, and if you would, go ahead and pick up what Mr. Madison states. Thank you so much.
The primary object is to secure an effectual discipline of the militia. This will no more be done if left to the states separately than the requisitions have been hitherto paid by them. The states neglect their militia now, and the more they are consolidated into one nation, the less each will rely on its own interior provisions for its safety, and the less prepare its militia for that purpose. In like manner, as the militia of a state would have been still more neglected than it has been if each county had been independently charged with the care of its militia. The discipline of the militia is evidently a national concern and ought to be provided for in the national constitution.
Okay. Now, Sean, this is Mr. Madison speaking, right?
Correct, sir.
And didn't he mention earlier that he thought that it needed to be, inclusive, that they would be providing for these things, but clearly he's saying that they should.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So go ahead and read Mr. Martin's little comment, and then go ahead, Sean, and read Mr. Randolph.
Mr. L. Martin was confident that the states would never give up the power over the militia, and that if they were to do so, the militia would be less tended to by the general than by the state governments. Mr. Randolph asked what danger there could be that the militia could be brought into the field and made to commit suicide on themselves. This is a power that cannot, from its nature, be abused, unless indeed the whole mass should be corrupted. He was for trammeling the general government whenever there was danger, but here there could be none. He urged this as an essential point, observing that the militia were everywhere neglected by the state legislatures, the members of which courted popularity too much to enforce a proper discipline. Leaving the appointment of officers to the state protects the people against every apprehension that could produce murmur.
Okay, so on the question of Mr. Elber's motion, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. Everybody else, no. So It carried in Connecticut, and that was it. Okay. So a motion was then made to recommit the second clause, which was negatived. And then on the question to agree to the first part of the clause, namely, quote, to make laws for organizing and arming, and disciplining the Navy, and for governing them, such part of them, as may be employed by the service of the U.S., close quote. New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts yes, Connecticut no. New Jersey yes, Pennsylvania yes, Delaware yes, Maryland no, and then Virginia yes, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia yes, yes, yes. So two against, what, eight, nine? So it carried. All right, so Mr. Madison then moved. Go ahead with this, Tammy.
Mr. Madison moved to amend the next part of the clause so as to read, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers under the rank of general officers.
Okay. Now, Mr. Sherman, go ahead and read the Mr. Sherman part two, or as well.
Mr. Sherman considered this as absolutely inadmissible. He said that if people should be so far asleep as to allow the most influential officers of the militia to be appointed by the general government, every man of discernment would rouse them by sounding the alarm to them.
Okay, so that's why the Constitution states, the end product states, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia. So who appoints the officers of the Army? Because the Army is technically to be deployed or configured or assembled by the state militias. Because it says in the Constitution to provide, or actually I think it is, where is it? To raise and support armies, but no appropriation made that shall be used for the longer term than 2 years. In other words, they can form an army, but they can't make it last for more than 2 years based on appropriation. And then how do they form the army? Just a little, the next couple down, it says, to provide for calling forth the militia for those purposes of executing the law, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. In other words, the functions of the army. So the point is that they have the power to call forth the militia to create the army, but the maintaining of the army is limited. And officers are appointed by the states. That doesn't happen today, does it, Sean?
No, it does not.
As a matter of fact, how many states have any input regarding Army officers?
I would say none.
And you're correct. So folks, just so you understand, because they've bypassed the Constitution, they're getting away with this. Go ahead with the next one, Sean.
Mr. Madison? Gary. Let us at once destroy the state governments, have an executive for life or hereditary, and a proper Senate, and then there would be some consistency in giving full powers to the general government. But as the states are not to be abolished, he wondered at the attempts that were made to give powers inconsistent with their existence. He warned the convention against pushing the experiment too far. Some people will support a plan of vigorous government at every risk. Others of a more democratic cast will oppose it with equal determination, and a civil war may be produced by the conflict. Prophet.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tammy, with Mr. Madison now.
Mr. Madison, as the greatest danger is that of disunion of the states, it is necessary to guard against it by sufficient powers to the common government, and as the greatest danger to liberty is from large standing armies, it is best to prevent them by an effectual provision for a good militia.
There you go. So there you go. The whole point of standing or protecting ourselves from a standing army is to basically have an effectual militia, or the provisions for doing that, which is why they had these two clauses in Article 1, Section 8, specifically for the militia. So let's jump past the voting, and let's pick up with Mr. Pinckney. Go ahead, Sean.
Mr. Pinckney urged the necessity of preserving foreign ministers and other officers of the United States independent of external influence and moved to insert after Article 7, Section 7, the clause following. Quote, no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of the legislature, except of any present emolument, office or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state, which passed no contest.
There you go. Okay. Mr. Rutledge then moved to amend Articles 8 to read as follows, and go ahead, Tammy.
Quote, this Constitution and the laws of the U.S. made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made under the authority of the U.S. shall be the supreme law of the several states and of their citizens and inhabitants, and the judges in the several states shall be bound thereby in their decisions. Anything in the constitutions or laws of the several states to the contrary notwithstanding, which was agreed to with no contest.
Okay. So go ahead, Sean, and read Mr. Governor Moore's, because now they're taking up Article 9 for consideration, but go ahead and read Governor Morris and Mr. Wilson's comments. And let me see here. Bum. These are all a bunch of short ones. Yeah, so at this point, go ahead and read those two, and then we'll have Tammy do two, and you do two, and so forth. Go ahead. Thanks.
I wanted to ask a question. If you could elaborate a little bit on this phrase, because it's always kind of caught me up. To the contrary, notwithstanding. Can you explain that in a less legalese, or maybe I'm just not understanding the context?
Okay, so what they're putting in here is the supremacy clause, right? That the United States Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, of the several supreme law of shall be the supreme law of the several states, but actually it ends up becoming the supreme law of the land. Let me get to what it actually says in Article 6. Shall be the supreme law of the land. That's what it ultimately ends up. So that supreme law of the several states and of the citizens and inhabitants, that gets changed to supreme law of the land. And the judges in the several states shall be bound thereby in their decision. Anything in the constitutions or laws of the several states to the contrary. Now, so in other words, if the states have some laws that are in conflict with the Constitution, they cannot stand against the Constitution. In other words, okay. The supreme law is the United States Constitution. And so when it comes to a conflict for the judges in the states, they are to side with the U.S. Constitution over the state constitutions. That's what they're basically saying. To the contrary, notwithstanding.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, sir. That helps a lot. Mr. Governor Morris argued against the appointment of officers by the Senate. He considered the body as too numerous for the purpose, as subject to cabal, and as devoid of responsibility. If judges were to be tried by the Senate, according to a late report of a committee, it was particularly wrong to let the Senate have the filling of vacancies which its own decrees were to create. Mr. Wilson was of the same opinion and for like reasons, the Article 9 being waived and Article 7, Section 1 resumed.
Okay, so Tammy, with Governor Morris and Mr. Governor Morris again. Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike the following words out of the 18 clause enforced treaties as being superfluous, since treaties were to be the laws, which was agreed to no contest. He also moved to alter the first part of 18 clause section 1 to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Article 7, so as to read, quote, to provide for calling forth the militia, which was agreed to without contest. On the question, then, to agree to the 18 clause of Section 1, Article 7, as amended. It passed in the affirmative with no contest.
Okay, so Mr. Pinckney, go ahead with him, and then I'll let Tammy pick up Mr. Broom, Sherman, and Madison. Go ahead with Mr. Pinckney. Thank you.
Mr. Colonel Pinckney moved to add as an additional power to be vested in the legislature of the United States to negative all laws passed by the several states interfering in the opinion of the legislature with the general interests and harmony of the Union, provided that two-thirds of the members of each house assent to the same. This principle, he observed, had formally been agreed to. He considered the precaution as essentially necessary. The objection drawn from the predominance of the large states had been removed by the equality established in the Senate.
Okay, Tammy, with Mr. Broom, Mr. Sherman, and then Mr. Madison. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Broom seconded the proposition. Mr. Sherman thought it unnecessary. The laws of the general government being supreme and paramount to the state laws according to the plan as it now stands. Mr. Madison proposed that it should be committed. He had been from the beginning a friend to the principal, but thought the modification might be made better.
Okay.
Mr. Mason wished to know how the power was to be exercised. Are all laws whatever to be brought up? Is no road nor bridge to be established without the sanction of the general legislature? Is this to sit constantly in order to receive and revise state laws? He did not mean by these remarks to condemn the expedient, but he was apprehensive that great objections would lie against it.
Okay.
Mr. Williamson thought it unnecessary, and having been already decided, a revival of the question was a waste of time.
Okay, so Tammy, go ahead and pick up Mr. Wilson and Mr. Rutledge, and then let me see here. Go ahead for yourself, Sean, to follow up with Ellsworth and Pinckney. And I think it's Charles Pinckney, by the way, not Colonel Pinckney. The C. Pinckney.
Okay, I saw the Mr. C.
Yeah. Then I think you're confusing him with General Pinckney, but anyway, that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Now we got three.
Yeah. Okay. All right, go ahead, Tammy.
Mr. Wilson considered this as the keystone wanted to complete the wide arch of the government we are raising. The power of self-defense had been urged as necessary for the state governments. It was equally necessary for the general government. The firmness of judges is not of itself sufficient. Something further is requisite. It will be better to prevent the passage of an improper law than to declare it void when passed. Mr. Rutledge, if nothing else, this alone would damn and ought to damn the Constitution. Will any state ever agree to be bound hand and foot in this manner? It is worse than making more corporations of them whose bylaws would not be subject to this shackle.
Okay.
Mr. Ellsworth observed that the power contended for would require either that all laws of the state legislatures should previously to their taking effect be transmitted to the general legislature or be repealable by the latter, or that the state executives should be appointed by the general government and have a control over the state laws. If the last was meditated, let it be declared. If the last was meditated, let it be declared. Mr. Pinckney declared that he thought the state executives ought to be so appointed with such a control, and that it would be so provided if another convention should take place.
Mr. Governor Morris did not see the utility or practicability of the proposition of Mr. Pinckney, but wished it to be referred to the consideration of a committee. And Mr. Langdon was in favor of the proposition. He considered it as resolvable into the question whether the extent of the national constitution was to be judged of by the general or the state governments. On that question for commitment, it passed in the negative.
In other words, it failed miserably. So, interestingly enough, again, Mr. Ellsworth was making a comment, and this is what he said. He observed that the power contended for would require either that all laws of the state legislatures should previously to their taking effect be transmitted to the general government or be repealable by the latter, or that the state executive should be appointed by the general government and have control over the state laws. In other words, they're still going down this idea at this point in time that the states cannot pass any laws that would, you know, be, well, because they talked about this at the very beginning, that the federal government, the federal legislature, Congress would be able to reach in and negate any state law that they didn't like, that they thought was a conflict. And so they're still maintaining that paradigm at this point in time. So in other words, they haven't gotten rid of it yet. They've only got a couple of weeks to go. So as we kind of, you know, move along a little bit more, they bring up debt again, and this is just a few pages down. Let me go ahead and cover it because it's just three citations. Mr. Butler, according to notice, moved that the clause, first section 1, article 7, as to the discharge of debt, be reconsidered tomorrow. He dwelt on the division of opinion concerning the domestic debts and the different pretensions of the different classes of holders. General Pinckney seconded the motion, and Mr. Randolph wished for a reconsideration in order to better the expression and to provide for the case of the state debts as is done by Congress. So at that point, you know, they were bringing up this the debt and still trying to settle where the federal government was going to be able to pick up and assume debt for the states or not. Now, debt's moving forward. Keep in mind that Congress already had the obligation over state debts and that the states had to pay their debts. Whether they were going to assume them was not on the table. The states had to pay their debts. So, what was the end? Because when we look at how it finalized, there was no power or there was no... The concept of assuming debt by the states for the war, and only for the war, was a wash. They just basically said, hey, we're just going to move forward the way it was, and we're going to honor those debts to the foreign nations, and we'll pay them based on those who owe the money. So anyway, as we move a little bit further down, and let me see, how far do we go? We go down to August... What is this? August 25th, and it's down on page, 365 at the very end with Colonel Mason. And so I'm not sure who read last, but at this point they're basically going to be considering some debt and some other, you know, things, and you can actually see how they're reading, you know, clause. The first clause of Section 1 of Article 7. Now, when you see that fact that they're talking about Article 7, Article 8, and so forth, that means that they haven't taken the 20-some articles of the Confederation and reformed them into the 7 articles. In other words, that was done really late by the Style Committee as they started really kind of going, okay, all these things were kind of agreed upon, so they started pushing them and reorganizing everything regarding the legislature into Article 1, everything regarding the executive into Article 2, so forth and so on. So are you with me, Sean, because we're going to be going into break here.
Colonel Mason, in answer to Governor Morris.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Hold it. August 25th, the very first.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The provision as it stands was necessary for the case of convicts in order to prevent the introduction of them. It was finally agreed, no contest, to make the clause read, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person.
Okay, so we're going into break. So what we'll do is we're going to pick this up. I didn't think he was... I thought we would have a dialogue instead of him reading, but anyway, that's okay. We'll just pick this up when we come back from the break, and that way we can kind of start anew, because, I mean, Sean didn't get too far. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, my sincere apology. I think I mentioned that we're going right into break, but anyway, I thought maybe you'd want to have something to talk about or not. But anywho, let's start with, and are you on Saturday, August 25th, which is page 365?
I am, sir.
Okay. And then the first thing is, this is where, this may not be highlighted, is Colonel Mason. Is that highlighted? Probably not highlighted in yours. Is that?
No, it is not.
That's where we're starting right
That's
there.
Where the confusion was.
Because no problem.
I went to the highlighted portion. And
I saw that. I saw that. That's okay. That's okay.
All right. So we want to start with Colonel Mason.
Yes, we're going to carry this on, because this is where they start talking about the debt and other things, because again, this goes down the path of how they use the state debt, something that the federal government wasn't to do, as the argument in setting up the bank. And so this is important, because this was truly a sleight of hand by a few of the people in Congress with the beguiling of Hamilton, the lying and the misrepresentation of Hamilton. So let's go ahead and start with Mr. Mason. Go ahead.
Colonel Mason objected to the term shall fulfill the engagements and discharge the debts, etc., as too strong. It may be impossible to comply with. The creditors should be kept in the same plight. They will in one respect be necessarily and properly in a better. The government will be more able to pay them. The use of the term shall will beget speculations and increase the pestilent practice of stock jobbing. There was a great distinction between original creditors and those who purchased fraudulently of the ignorant and distressed. He did not mean to include those who have bought stock in the open market. He was sensible of the difficulty of drawing the line in this case, but he did not wish to preclude the attempt. Even fair purchasers at 5, 4, 5, 6, 8 for 1 did not stand on the same footing with first holders, supposing them not to be blamable. The interest they receive, even in paper, is equal to their purchase money. What he particularly wished was to leave the door open for buying up the securities, which he thought would be precluded by the term shall, as requiring nominal payment, and which was not inconsistent with his ideas of public faith. He was afraid also the word shall might extend to all the old continental paper.
Interesting, and he kind of gives an insight to the fact that there was a market for buying government debt, just like there is today. You'd think that back in those days they weren't that creative, but apparently they were. Go ahead, Tammy, read Mr. Langdon and then Mr. Gary, if you would, please. Thank you.
Mr. Langdon wished to do more than leave the creditors in status quo. Mr. Gary said that for himself, he had no interest in the question being not possessed of more of the securities than would by the interest pay his taxes. He would observe, however, that as the public had received the value of the literal amount, they ought to pay that value to somebody. The frauds on the soldiers ought to have been foreseen. These poor and ignorant people could not but part with their securities. There are other creditors who will part with anything rather than be cheated out of capital of their advances. The interest of the states, he observed, was different on this point, some having more, others less than their proportion of the paper. Hence, the idea of a scale for reducing its value had risen. If the public faith would admit, of which he was not clear, he would not object to a revision of the debt so far as to compel restitution to the ignorant and distressed who have been defrauded. As to stock jobbers, he saw no reason for the censures thrown on them. They keep up the value of the paper. Without them, there would be no market.
Okay, so let's go ahead and pick up with Mr. Butler and then Mr. Randolph. Sean, go ahead.
Mr. Butler said he meant neither to increase nor diminish the security of the creditors. Mr. Randolph moves to postpone the clause in favor of the following. Mm-hmm. Quote, all debts contracted and engagements entered into by or under the authority of Congress shall be as valid in the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation. Dr. Johnson, the debts are the debts of the U.S., of the great body of America. Changing the government cannot change the obligation of the United States, which devolves, of course, on the new government. Nothing was in his opinion necessary to be said. If anything, it should be a mere declaration, as moved by Mr. Randolph.
Okay. All right, so, Tammy, go ahead and pick up, let me see here, Governor Morris, and then, Sean, you can go ahead and pick up the Mr. Sherman, then we'll get into the general Pinckney, because those are kind of little parcels again, so let's do it that way. Go ahead, Tammy.
Okay, Mr. Governor Morris said he never had become a public creditor, that he might urge with more propriety the compliance with public faith. He had always done so, and always would, and preferred the term shall as most explicit. As to buying up the debt, the term shall was not inconsistent with it. If provision be first made for paying the interest, if not, such an expedient was a mere evasion. He was content to say nothing, as the new government would be bound, of course, but would prefer the clause with the term shall, because it would create many friends to the plan.
Okay. Go ahead, Sean.
So on that motion,
for the most part, it carried. I think yeah. I only saw one no. Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Sherman, Sean.
Mr. Sherman thought it necessary to connect with the clause for laying taxes, duties, etc., an express provision for the object of the old debts, etc., and moved to add to the first clause of the first section, Article 7, quote, for the payment of said debts and for the defraying the expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense and general welfare, end quote. The proposition as being unnecessary was disagreed to, Connecticut alone being in the affirmative.
Okay.
The report of the Committee of 11, see Friday the 24th instant, being taken up.
Insert, I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to talk a little bit more about the importation of slaves. And I think this might be where the pushing back of the year is when Madison kind of took exception. So let's go ahead and, Tammy, why don't you read Colonel Pinckney, Mr. Gorham, and then Mr. Madison, and we'll stop there for a sec.
Importation of slaves, General Pinckney moved to strike out the words the year 1800 as the year limiting the importation of slaves and to insert the words the year 1808. Mr. Gorham seconded the motion. Mr. Madison, 20 years will produce all of the mischief that can be apprehended from the liberty to import slaves. So long a term will be more dishonorable to the national character than to say nothing about it in the Constitution.
Okay.
On the motion which passed in the affirmative.
So, and barely, but so I think this is when Mr. Madison, and because he was writing it, he just didn't expound. Because I believe it was others that said, you know, who's going to remember 20 years from now this little clause that says that the federal government in Article 1, Section 9 shall have the ability after 20 years in 1808 to begin restricting the importation of persons. What is that going to mean? And who's going to remember what that means and who's going to do that? So this is where I think he kind of gets animated in the meeting of, you know, kind of having a, I don't want to call it a meltdown, but it probably was the closest thing he had to a meltdown. But anyway, Sean, let's go ahead and pick up with Governor Morris and Colonel Mason. And then, Tammy, you go ahead and cover Sherman, Clymer, Williamson, and Governor Morris again. And then I'll have Sean pick up Mr. Dickinson, and we'll take it from there. Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris was for making the clause read at once. Importation of slaves into North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia shall not be prohibited, etc. This, he said, would be most fair and would avoid the ambiguity by which, under the power with regard to naturalization, the liberty reserved to the states might be defeated. He wished it to be known also that this part of the Constitution was a compliance with those states. If the language, however, should be objected to by the members from those states, he should not urge it. Colonel Mason was not against using the term slaves, but against naming North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, lest it should give offense to the people of those states.
Okay. All right. So, Tammy, go ahead.
Mr. Sherman liked a description better than the terms proposed, which had been declined by the old Congress and were not pleasing to some people. Mr. Clymer concurred with Mr. Sherman. Mr. Williamson said that both in opinion and practice he was against slavery, but thought it more in favor of humanity from a view of all circumstances to let in South Carolina and Georgia on those terms than to exclude them from the Union. Mr. Governor Morris withdrew his motion.
Okay. So, go ahead, Sean, with Mr. Dickinson.
Mr. Dickinson wished the clause to be confined to the states which had not themselves prohibited the importation of slaves, and for that purpose moved to amend the clause so as to read, quote, the importation of slaves into such of the states as shall permit the same shall not be prohibited by the legislature of the United States until the year 1808, which was disagreed to no contest. The first part of the report was then agreed to, amended as follows. Quote, the migration or importation of such persons as the several states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the legislature prior to the year 1808. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia, no.
Okay. So, Tammy, go ahead and read Mr. Baldwin, Mr. Sherman, and all the way down to, put this in halves, all the way down to Colonel Mason. Okay?
Okay. Mr. Baldwin, in order to restrain and more explicitly define, quote, the average duty, unquote, move to strike out of the second part of the words, quote, average of the duties laid on imports, unquote, and insert, quote, common imposts on articles not enumerated, end quote, which was agreed to without contest. Mr. Sherman was against this second part, as acknowledging men to be property by taxing them as such under the character of slaves. Mr. King and Mr. Landon considered this as the price of the first part. General Pinckney admitted that it was so. Colonel Mason, not to tax will be equivalent to a bounty on the importation of slaves.
All right, so go ahead. Yeah, as a matter of fact, go ahead and read all the way down to Mr. Mason. Mr. Madison. Thank you.
Mr. Gorham thought that Mr. Sherman should consider the duty not as implying that slaves are property, but as a discouragement to the importation of them. Mr. Governor Morris remarked that as the clause now stands, it implies that the legislature may tax free men imported. Mr. Sherman, in answer to Mr. Gorham, observed that the smallness of the duty showed revenue to be the object, not the discouragement of the importation. Mr. Madison thought it wrong to admit in the Constitution the idea that there could be property in men. The reason of duties did not hold, as slaves are not like merchandise, consumed, etc.
Okay.
Colonel Mason, in answer to Governor Morris, the provision as it stands was necessary for the case of convicts in order to prevent the introduction of them. It was finally agreed, no contest, to make the clause read, quote, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person. And then the second part, as amended, was agreed to. Section 5, Article 7 was agreed to, no contest, as reported. Section 6, Article 7 in the report was postponed on motion of Mr. Madison, seconded by Mr. Governor Morris.
Okay, so now, before we move further down, let me just give you an idea here. What would have happened, because some of these men really felt that union was paramount. In other words, maintaining the union, they didn't think that they could survive without all of the states. Sherman of Connecticut brought that up, and other states kind of lent to that, why they were willing to let the South maintain slavery. And actually, why they just didn't go and leap forward and say, let's get rid of slavery. Now, I honestly think that there possibly was maybe some of the Virginians, Maryland, because slavery was in Maryland as well as Delaware at that time, too. And that's why they kind of weren't really making a big issue of it, because they weren't going to get rid of it, per se, but they weren't going to make a big issue of it. I would say this, that I would have loved to have seen the absolute push to say, we get rid of slavery, period. Slavery's gone. If you're a state, because when you really look at it, it's not like it was going to be New Jersey, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Georgia as the four states that were going to maintain slavery. In other words, if you look at the impact of that, that would have put some real gaps between the states, where they would have had to traverse the states that weren't going to be in the Union to get to the next state that was in the Union. Does that make sense? In other words, by clustering them all into one, in other words, from North Carolina south, it didn't matter how they moved commerce. They were those states, if they would have drawn the line, they all would have been in the Union. That makes sense, right?
I think so. I think one of the reasons that they were so strongly committed to the Union over all else, and this is just my thoughts on it, is that they knew about history in Europe and how that ended up with all these wars going on and everybody always battling over territory. And if they were united, then that would help to prevent that from happening and keep other countries, because that the European countries were just waiting for disarray to happen in on a new continent so that they could come in and take advantage of it.
Right.
And I think that was the priority for the Union.
Okay, but so when I look at the geography, we're talking about North Carolina and South. So in other words, Virginia would have been the southern border, and with the United States or the Union would have been solid all the way up to Maine, all the way up to Canada. So had they taken the line and said, we're getting rid of it, And if you guys want to go your own way, then that's fine. Because it's not like there would have been pockets that would have been very it wouldn't have been advantageous. It would have been a disadvantage for the states to move commerce around these states that could possibly be then susceptible to foreign influence and so forth. Because they were isolated, they could have easily been picked off. Now, let me put this on the table. As soon as they got picked, as soon as some foreign nation, France or whomever, wanted to come over and basically start, you know, harassing them and looking to, you know, kind of claim them, Britain or whoever, the only thing they had to do was give up slavery, because either that or they're going to become subjected. And so the only thing they'd have to do is give up slavery, and the northern states would come down and save them from finally being overcome or being overrun. I look at the faith that they had, or the lack of faith that they had, in surrendering and doing the right thing, the northern states, I think that they kind of missed the opportunity. Because I think
I absolutely agree.
I think history would have been written completely different. That because right here in the convention, these men knew that they needed these northern states to fight and defend them. And are they really? I'm going to tell you that as they go south with, you know, the fact that, well, we got kicked out because we took a stand on slavery, and they said, okay, we're moving on without you. Get out of here. And so we're out of the Union. That would let them chew on that for a few, you know, few minutes, and then all of a sudden realize, hey, you know how vulnerable we are. What's it going to take to stay in the Union? We got to give up slavery. Oh, is that impossible? Can we do it? I mean, it would have forced the issue, because they know, at least I would just say calculating minds would have probably put it on the table to say, look, everybody knows that our hands are tied in maintaining slavery. We can't defend ourselves. So any ship that starts coming into our port with a foreign flag that looks like it's got armament and so forth, that it could be a ship of war, it's done. We're done. So are we really going to take this position and keep this position, or are we going to, you know, get on and join the Union as free states? They would have had it done, I think. I think that would have really done it, because I think they would have came to their senses. Everybody already knew well in advance in this convention where they were talking about, hey, we need you guys, the northern guys, to fight our wars. We'll pay for it. Don't worry.
Yeah, that's an interesting point of view, yeah.
Go die for us, because I think that that's what the northern states should have said. We're not going to die for you. Either you get rid of it, or you maintain the liability and protect yourselves, and then be done with it. Because I honestly think that had they been forced to face, you know, death by their own devices or their own, you know, addiction, then okay, I think they would have given it up. Think they would have
had natural consequences.
Yep, that's right. Anyway, so that's just my point on what really should have happened. But for some reason, this concept of union was just so important. And so the question is, how many of these men, because I saw some comments by Northerners go, it's a state issue, just leave them alone. And I'm going, huh? Where were their true sentiments? Were they truly, you know, embracing liberty, or were they, you know, it doesn't matter, I don't care. I'm making my money, they're making theirs. To be indifferent like that over something as repugnant as that, it's hard to get my mind wrapped around. But then again, you know, when we look at it, who became the advocates of slavery in the early 1800s? It was the Northern Democrats. Where did the first Ku Klux Klan organization get formed? It was formed in the North, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going...
By the Democrats.
By the Democrats, correct. And that was when in New York, they started denying black freemen the right to vote. That was the beginning of the racist oppression through the non-slave states, the supposedly the abolition states. This all happened courtesy of Hamilton. So when Hamilton gave John Adams the list of lawyers to promote into the midnight judge seats, almost all of those lawyers were pro-slavery because Hamilton was looking to divide America on using slavery as the divisive tactic to basically divide and conquer us. Because as long as he could keep everybody focused on slavery, he could continue getting away with doing things in the background with basically pushing us towards Britain. Because it seemed like that's what he was trying to do. Undermine the Constitution and move us back under and into the arms of Britain. But the one thing he didn't see was Aaron Burr not shooting over his head because he shot over Aaron Burr's head. In the duel. In the famous duel when they went over, they rode over to this island in these rowboats, and Hamilton, gave the gesture because he had the advantage, and he shot over Aaron Burr's head to say, okay, this is nonsense. I'm not going to kill you. Are you really going to kill me? And Burr just aimed right for his chest and shot him.
He said, yep.
Yeah, I'm so sick of you. And the sad part was Hamilton's wife was there, and she helped row him back. And it was a long, painful, agonizing death. I think his family was, at his bedside. They didn't take him home, but there was a place where, they had him rest because moving him was very painful. And so, anyway, yeah, it was, I think it took him quite a few hours to pass away. So, anyway. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it just doesn't pay to be arrogant. He should have at least winged him, clipped him, so that his good arm couldn't have shot him. And said, okay, at least I didn't kill you. Something.
Bless his heart.
Something. But anyway, so that kind of kills today. What we'll do next in our next show is we'll jump down to, what is this, page 383, like the Plymouth Magnum engine, 383. And we will look at... starting there in our next episode. So we're getting very close to the end, folks, because we're looking at the end of August. This is Wednesday, August 29th. So we're moving along, and we're almost done with the Constitution Convention. So all that being said, folks, it's easy to, what the armchair quarterback or hindsight being 2020, it's easy to see things differently. But I don't think these men knew the despair and the problems and just the hate and animosity that still brews this nation today. They just didn't know. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.